Hello, hello, hello. It's a beautiful day today. And today is a special day because we're starting a brand new podcast. And as you look at me, I am not the person who this podcast belongs to. I'm just here to just lay the red carpet for, I think, what will be a very special conversation. So I would like to introduce to you somebody called Nekesa Were. Now, she is a rugby aficionado. She's a person who's passionate about people, passionate about community. And one of her very big passions is also African women rugby. Now, she has a very interesting story to it, and I won't take too much of time before she starts talking. So directly over to you. Hello, Nekesa.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great.
Please introduce yourself in your own words.
But you just introduced me already, Laura.
No, but people need to know you as you. So who is Nekesa and what are we talking about today? What's happening here?
Well, I'm Nekesa. I, like Laura said, I'm a rugby aficionado. I love the sport. I've grown up around the sport. I have a passion for getting to know people and what drives them. I love to hear what they say, but I also love to hear what they don't say. And over the course of my 20 years plus involved in rugby, I've developed a real passion for women's rugby that I feel is underserved, underreported. And so there's so many fabulous stories to tell that I'm hoping that this podcast will do.
So you've just put a really big number there, 20 years. Huh. And in my head, okay, so I started watching rugby. I couldn't do, if it's not sevens, I could not watch rugby because I'm like, this game is long. People just hurting each other on the pitch. What is it about rugby that you love? Okay,
so I love exactly what you're saying, that people hurt themselves on the pitch.
She doesn't mean it, but
no, I love the physicality of it. Mm. It feels for me like poetry in motion. Of, you know, it's like just watching the players on the pitch,
yeah. And
just what it takes, understanding what it takes for a player to be able to move the way that they do, to be able to think the way that they think. You know, it's more than going to the gym. It's about putting your mind in the game, understanding yourself, understanding your teammates. So there's so many things at play when you see players on the pitch. And for me, that's what gets me. I wish I could. I can't play the sport. I've never played the sport.
So it's like a dance.
It's a dance.
So you have to really trust your body. I'm just trying to pick from your words to say, okay, maybe this is what it means.
You do have to trust your body, but more than that, you need to trust your teammate.
Explain that to me.
So you need to get to a point where there's chemistry between you. And I think that's what separates some teams from others, the better performing teams from not so good performing teams, is the chemistry between the players. Do you know your teammate? Can you anticipate their moves? You know, because it doesn't always go according. You could make plans for how the game is going to go, but it doesn't always go that way. So are you able to pick up, okay, right, Laura is doing this on the pitch. That means next I'm going to have to be here to receive the ball from her. Are you able to do that stuff between the two of you?
Is that why there's so much camaraderie between?
Yes.
Like it's almost like a club you're not allowed to be part of.
Well, yes, I think that's it, because you really need to get to know each other on the pitch and off the pitch. And when those two relationships are developed, then that's when you get your A-star players, really. Mm. Yeah.
So if you look at rugby, and right now I was talking about men's rugby in my head, what's the difference, apart from gender, between men's rugby and women's rugby?
So I was going to say no difference. There's absolutely no difference. But I just right now was remembering a conversation I was having as we're watching our women's team. So I'm a member of Kenya Harlequins, and we have a women's team. They're called the Queens, the Queens Queens.
Oh, there you go. So, the Queens Queens.
So we're watching them play the other day, and someone standing next to me said, "Women's rugby is just so beautiful. The way they pass the ball is so intentional, and it looks like silk." Mm-hmm. That's how they described it. They say it looks like silk, the way they pass that ball. It's just so beautiful. So I want to go with that. That's the difference. The women's game looks like and feels like silk.
I like that. So okay, I've tried to throw the rugby ball. It's not easy. So making it silky, probably even harder. But so in my head, the way I would see it is women's rugby is just as physical. But then is it wrong to say there's a softness to it? But the softness comes not from the physicality, but the character of women. I'm talking as somebody who has never watched women's rugby, so please don't judge me.
And I'm trying to think about this really. I mean, yes, I think there's aspects of it, or maybe it's a personality trait where some players will be softer in the way that they, you know, that they play than others. Mm. But then there's others for who it's not. You know, I think it's just different styles of play. Maybe inherently with the way we are built, you know, women players may tend, it may sometimes appear to be a softer game, but then the more you watch it, the more you realize, honestly, Laura, there just is no difference. The tackles are just as hard. The runs are just as fast. You know, the celebrations are just as big. Mm. You know, the disappointments are just as sad. So,
yeah, because I guess if you are putting your all into it, then you're going to get out there. So what, why are you having this podcast? Why is it important for you to talk about women's rugby in Africa?
Because when I began to get the point where I wanted to hear and watch those stories, I didn't find them. Mm. I knew they existed because I've been involved in the sport for a long time, including, you know, like, managing a women's national team. So I knew there were other women's national teams out there. But it's not that easy to get the stories. Yes, you will see a rugby union website with something about women's fixtures and so on. But then I wanted to know the women that were playing, and I wanted to know the women that were running the sport. And I struggled to find those articles, and I struggled to find those podcasts. And so I thought, I want to do my part. I know there's some out there, and I found the one or two. Mm. And so I wanted to add mine into that pot.
So wait, just rewind a little bit. You managed the national women's rugby team.
Mm-hmm.
How long for?
I think it was 2 seasons, 2 years-ish. Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about that. Like, how did you get there? What did you do when you were there? Why did you leave? How was that experience? Oh, that's a fine story. Yeah. I can see from your reaction. I want to know.
How did I get there? I mean, how far back do we go?
There too. I'm here. I'm here to listen to your story.
So I got into rugby at the university playing level. So basically I was, because my brother played for Mean Machine, University of Nairobi's Mean Machine, I followed that team quite a bit. I also followed Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology, Cougars, because my other brother played for, you know. So anyway, I followed my brother's playing. And following my brother's playing, I found myself within the rugby fraternity. I like to tell people I went from having 2 brothers to having 20 plus brothers because, aww, you know, you're Wera's small sister and so you're everyone's sister.
I love that.
And so the rugby space for me was always a very safe space because that's what I experienced the moment I stepped into it. And so following one of my brothers, his name is Ao Kagasheo, who much later on became the CEO of the Kenya Rugby Union. Mm-hmm. So he held my hand basically into the Kenya Rugby Union and showed me around and gave me things to do and so on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I ended up doing when I met people at Kenya Rugby Union was aligning to the women's rugby team. And that was much early on. This was a time when they're still learning how to control the game, how to control the ball, how to pass it, how to kick. So it was real. It was really.
So it had a much later start.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Oh yeah, women's rugby had a much later start. And so, yes, we had women players, but I guess we didn't have too many women administrators, you know. And so an opportunity presented itself, and I got the appointment, you know. And at that time, we were playing mostly Uganda. I think in the time that I managed the team, it was maybe only once or twice that we actually got to play South Africa. So even the exposure wasn't that much then. Mm. But I loved it. I mean, it was my peers or maybe women that were just a little younger than me, you know. And so I loved observing them. I loved to watch them play the game. I love to watch them psych each other up. I love to watch the excitement, you know, going to Uganda, going, you know, wherever. First time some of them were traveling, you know, first time on a plane and all of this. And so there was so much excitement and so many firsts for all of us, including me. I mean, I'd never managed a rugby club, let alone a national team. And it's kind of like you're thrust into it. Mm. No one really gives you a course on this is how, you, at least back then.
Purely driven by passion.
You know, it's purely driven by passion. You think you can do it? I'm like,
I'll give it a go.
Yeah. So I gave it a go. And it was mostly a good run. But there were several challenges, similar to some of the challenges we face now. Obviously, the exposure. So, you know, you're playing a game and no one's watching. That can be quite demoralizing. Yeah. For the women, obviously coming from diverse backgrounds, some of them couldn't afford the basics, you know, like boots, you know, or sports bras and that kind of stuff. So that was hard to see and things that we needed to navigate. And then you asked, why did you leave? And so this was, it was a camp just down in South Sea. Getting ready for, I think, must have been getting ready for an international fixture. And I remember that we're all, I think it was some dorm somewhere. And so at some point, there was like silence. I'm like, where is everyone? And so I walk down the hall and I discover that all the players are in this room and they're having this conversation, just so frustrated about not having been paid. You know, and I mean, still have those stories today. So not much has changed, unfortunately. You know, but it's just the frustration of we haven't been paid. You know, what should we do about it? Should we not take the pitch? You know, it's conversations that athletes have when they're kind of debating, like, where do we draw the line between what we must have? Like, what's our non-negotiables? You know, and I loved that there was this kamkunji going on. There's this meeting going on where they were trying to have a rational conversation about it. But I also felt so deflated because I couldn't do anything about it. You know, it was just, you know, when you're told kangumu, you know, just like just hang in there and get this thing done. And we'd done that for so long. You know, and at that moment when they were actually having this conversation about we want to take the pitch, but we need to draw this line somewhere, I honestly just felt so deflated and I felt this was bigger than me and that I just couldn't. I couldn't help them in that moment. And I remember I just messaged my husband and he said, you know what, this is probably not the way I should leave, but I think this is, I just need to leave because I'm just not helping this situation right now.
Where was the money coming from at the time and how much money was coming in?
To
be a kamkunji, just to paint the picture.
It's so much. I mean, if you consider that we're paying, or we're honoring them with a lot more today than we did then, then we weren't talking about much. They can't have been asking, if I had to put a figure to it, I don't think that any one of them was owed more than 5,000 bob, honestly.
Per game?
Just generally at that time when this had become an issue for them, you know.
How is the payment done usually? Are you paid per season? Are you paid per game? Are you paid per team? Or how does it work? What is the, let's say, the going structure?
Well, it really depends. If you're talking about it at a club level, then it might be per game or per training session.
Okay.
You know, although just for efficiency, it might be that this is the amount you get per training session and this is what you get per game, but then we're going to pay it at the end of the month. Or it might be that we're going to pay it at the end of each week. It really depends on the cash flows of the, you know, of the different clubs. At a national team level, ideally you should sign a contract.
Ideally.
Yeah. Ideally you should sign a contract. You know, and sometimes those contracts were signed and sometimes they weren't, and then they weren't honored, you know, and so then you're probably then coming back into training and what you had been promised before hasn't been paid, but there's a promise that it will be paid eventually. So I think the women were really at a point where promises had been made and broken, you know, and that literally then breaks you, you know, as, you know, as a player. And so for me, it, I just couldn't. I felt like it was a situation I couldn't help at all. Mm. And so I wanted to step away from it. But it always was on the back of my mind as that one time that I didn't do what I set out to do as far as the rugby, far as the rugby space. So I would always come back to it as a point of failure for myself, that the women needed this thing and I wasn't able to help them do it. Because I just felt, honestly, by that time I'd fought and fought and there wasn't much else that I could do. And so for me, this podcast is actually partly an effort to go back to that moment and do something about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
As they say, it's never too late. So I do feel like you have something going on here. But I'm going to take you back.
Mm-hmm.
You need to tell me how much people are paid for training, how much people are paid for games. Just for us to get an idea, because you can have as many kamkunjis as you want.
Yeah.
Unless we understand what you were going through, we might not be able to even see the frustration or why they were frustrated. So if you were to just give a ballpark, ballpoint figure, and I is it ballpoint or ballpark?
Ballpoint is a pen.
Ballpark figure. So I'm just curious to know how much people were paid, and because I just want a picture in my mind. If you're going for training, you have to be so focused on the training that you're doing. So
I mean, the truth is I can't remember the actual amount, but let's set it in context of your typical rugby club. Now when a player shows up for training, depending on the club, they're maybe getting 300 to 700 shillings for showing up for training. So that's maybe three sessions
a week.
Mm-hmm. And then you make the team. So you're playing on a Saturday, whenever the game is. Maybe you're getting 1,000 or 1,500. Again, depends on the club. Some clubs That's now.
Whoa.
Right. So back then, we're probably talking 200, 300, you know. In fact, I know some of our players who would come, whose motivation to begin playing rugby was to get that 200 bob when they came for training, you know. So we're not even talking colossal amounts of money. So maybe 5x or 10x that for a national team, you know, and maybe say that after they have successfully represented the national side, they're getting upwards of 50k. I don't know. It's just in the context of what someone would be fighting for, you could fight for much bigger things.
So even when you're saying the 5k, you're looking at 5k a month at that time?
At club level, yes, potentially. Whoa. Yeah.
So this okay. What are some of the things, apart from that fight? You know, women are observant, and I think you're more observant than a lot of people that I know. What are some of the stories that you can share, of course, at your discretion, that just never left you from that time?
So one story, like I said, is definitely when I learned that there were women living in informal areas who would work or pay 20 bob to get to training just to be able to go back home with 200 bob. You know, for me, that was like this is their livelihood. You know, this is the reason, because they want to get 200 bob and on the way home buy some food. So you're getting home and you're walking in with something and you're saying, I worked for this, you know. And to think that there's still players in that position now who count on rugby for their livelihood and for that 200, 300 bob that they're getting at the end of the day to basically sustain them. Like, this is their life's plan currently. This is how they intend to exist. For me, is we can do better, you know, when I think about that, you know. Or to think about women who just have that desire to play professionally. You know, when I was managing the women's team, there were some women that played basketball and netball and so on. And then saw rugby and saw how well rugby was doing. And they're like, I'm going to play for that national team. So I'm jumping over. And you still have women today who play other sports other than rugby, I guess, still trying to figure out, you know, where the where there's more pathway for them to do, you know, what they'd like to do.
Mm.
You know, and so seeing, you know, similar to the men, women also have desires and dreams. You know, they want to play for the national team and so on and so forth. For them, that's the motivation coming into rugby, you know. But then to come into rugby and then for no one to see you for what you are, which is an athlete, you know, or in my case, for people to not see me as someone that wants to support the game, to administer the game, you know, that's who, I think that for me was another motivation to begin to tell stories, because I got a bit frustrated with assumptions of why women would be in rugby, with assumptions of why I would be in rugby.
What are some of those assumptions?
So,
because you look like they're still upsetting you.
They still upset me. And I see those people who made those assumptions and I'm just like, but God.
Stop it.
If it wasn't for God. You know, but I mean, it's not just specific to the rugby space. But so for me, it would be instances like, oh, so Nekesa is now tournament director for this tournament. Who did she sleep with? Or who wanted to sleep with her? You know, or just things like a woman walking in to watch rugby because they love the game. And then there's just, it's just an uncomfortable space for you to be with the catcalls and so on. It's so ridiculous. I was having a conversation. So I had a round table for women because I was planning this tournament and I wanted to understand, why don't you come when we host this tournament? Why don't you guys come? And it's crazy that the stories that women have of rugby are, it's just the moment I walk in through those gates, it's just uncomfortable. I need to figure, in fact, before I walk in, like while I'm at home, I need to figure out how do I draw a compromise between what I want to wear and what will be acceptable because of who I'm going to find there. Once I walk in, which is the path that I can use, where all these people sitting on the stands are not going to see me and make me feel so uncomfortable. And so you have a lot of women walking behind stands for that exact reason.
Whoa.
Right? Who am I going to go with so I can feel safe?
You know? It shouldn't be a consideration. Yeah.
It shouldn't be a consideration anywhere, you know? And it's just frustrating that you have, as a woman playing rugby, you have these frustrations on the, you have frustrations of just trying to make a team, but now you also have frustrations of people are going to see me as less than an athlete. They're going to see me as a piece of meat that they can talk about, you know, and it's just a frustrating space to be. And I'm hoping by putting faces to these women and telling stories, their rugby stories, that people begin to see them for who they are and what their dreams are. More than anything else.
And just be a bit more considerate.
Be a bit more considerate.
I'm going to say something now, and I feel like it's at the producer's discretion to remove it if they want to. But today when I was actually preparing to come, I have a small hip issue. And so I have a walking stick I'm using. But because of the walking stick, I'm leaning towards one side. So even my shoulder's gone down that side. But then because I'm limping, I always think of this girl that we used to have in school who always had a limp, and it was very weird to see her on the window. And I wonder if I'm being punished for laughing at her as a child at this hair beard. And so it just made me think, you know, sometimes you look at somebody's situation, it's good to understand what people are going through.
Yeah.
Because many times that limp has come from somewhere else. Could have been an accident, could have been, and to take someone down without hearing their story, I think is a very important lesson as humans that we need to embrace.
Yeah.
Sorry for putting myself in your podcast. But yeah. I just
I love that analogy. Love it.
But you know, I honestly have no interaction with women's rugby. And let me say, okay, if you could paint a picture of here in Kenya right now, how many teams are we looking at? How many women players do we have? How often do we have women's rugby tournaments here in Kenya? Now, with the exposure that you noticed a while back, is it better? Do which teams do we really play with now? Which teams, even when you hear we're going to play them, you're like, whoa. just paint a picture for us.
I think what I love about where we are now is that there is a lot of grassroots rugby, which we didn't have in the past. So back in my time when I was managing this women's team, like I said, that was their first, for many of them, that was their first. You can imagine it being your first interaction, understanding the game and how to play it. And then within months or maybe a year or so, now you're in the national team, you know, like that, that curve is crazy. But now we have little kids, little girls playing rugby, being taught the game. If you go to the academies, there's boys and there's girls learning the game. If you go to your your primary schools, whether public, whether private, there's girls, you know, learning the game. Go to high schools, there's girls, women, you know, playing the game. And so I love that we're beginning to set out that foundation and understanding that you need to catch them early. By the time they're getting to universities, if that's where they're learning it from scratch, then it's a little too late for some of them. So that foundation has been set, and that's fantastic. And then our national team, I feel, is doing incredibly well. I was having a conversation with a friend about them, and it really feels as though they're on a path, they're on a World Cup path. They might even likely get to a World Cup before the men. That's they're doing so well, you know. And the growth has just been amazing, both looking at individual players, looking at the way that the team is run, looking at the camaraderie amongst the women and just the drive that they have to make things work. You know, and so those two bits I feel are working really well. Grassroots level, national team level, as far as the team is working really well. I think we still have some work to do at the center, which is where clubs like the one that I belong to, you know, this is where we reside at the center.
Queens.
You know, and so and so what's happening now is that you have young girls, young women that are ready to play, but there's not enough opportunity at the center for them to do so. And the reason there isn't enough opportunity is because not enough clubs are able to have women's rugby teams. You know, we have, I think, about eight now. Eight women's rugby teams at club level. But we're struggling to maintain a league, you know, because there's going to be costs for training. There's going to be costs to get the women to where they need to play. And the moment you need to travel somewhere, then double that cost and so on. So even in the league now, I think another thing to highlight is that there's a Women's Kenya Cup, which is fantastic that we have that going on with these eight teams or so. But even with that, we find there's going to be a walkover or a team is going to ask, can we move our game to this and that date? Because we're still trying to fundraise, you know, so that we can honor that fixture, you know. And so it's great that we have that league going, but then the circumstances are making it so it's not as effective as it could be, right? So this centerpiece banks on clubs to have a women's team and be able to manage it, right? And so to put in context, you have your men's team that plays a Kenya Cup, and then you probably have another men's team that plays what we call the Eric Shally Shield, and then you now have a women's team to play the Women's Kenya Cup. So that's three teams that need to train, that need to show up to a game, that need to be kitted, that need potentially to be fed, you know, and all of this. So that's a lot. So a lot of teams will then decide not to have a women's side because you're dealing with so much else. And no one said you must. They said it's good to have, you know, and if within your culture or your structure, you see the benefit of women's rugby, then you'll do everything that you can to have it. But then that's not everyone. You know, it's really up to you what you want to do and not to. So some clubs will opt not to have a women's side. We opted to have one even when we didn't know where the money was going to come from. We said, you know what, there's absolutely no way that Kenya Harlequins doesn't have a women's side. So we're going to have a women's side, you know, but we've just managed to figure it out along the way. So you asked which are the teams, which...
what teams do we play with? And, you know, like, where are we, I guess, in from an African perspective?
From an African perspective, the ones we love to hate, you know, using that term very loosely, are Uganda. I think there's just that relationship between Kenya, Uganda, regardless what sport.
They're very competitive.
We're very competitive. You know, and the banter when these two, you know, countries meet is fantastic. It's always playful. It's like you want to be there.
Mm.
You know, when we have Kenya hosting Uganda, we so look forward to having the Uganda corner, you know, on the grounds, and just the laughing and the singing and the teasing that's going on from there is always fantastic. So the Kenya-Uganda fixture is always one to watch. And I feel perhaps mostly because we've kind of grown together.
Mm.
We've been each other's like check because I think the sports, the two countries began more or less same time. And so, and were each other's competition for the longest time. When you spoke about international rugby for Kenya, it's Uganda. So we know each other inside out, and it's always a fantastic one. And you never know who's going to win because we're just so much, you know, at par.
That's cool.
Yeah. As far as benchmarking, like where do we want to be? Mm. For me, it would be South Africa. Mm. Not just the physicality on the pitch, but then also the way that the game is run. You know, I remember when I was managing the team. So every team kind of has their space, you know, where they set up between games, you know, that's where you go back to and so on and so on. And so we had our base quite close to South Africa. In fact, I think they're just literally next, like a tent next to us, you know. And so I kept on looking at them and just how organized everything was. Gee, their tech bench had your many people. Mm. Gee, they had a warm-up shirt, and then they had this, and then they had, you know, and then they were drinking this, and then they were eating that. I'm like, man, are we in the same country, literally? Are we playing the same sport, right? But just the way that the game is supported, and I see this with Zimbabwe as well, the way that those games are supported at all levels, you know, from a from the governing body level, and the way that trickles down to how the game then is developed with sports academies and all of this. And then I think that is what then manifests when the team does so well on the pitch, right? And that would be my dream. That would be my dream for rugby, not just for the women, but for the men as well.
Mm.
Just that level of intentionality in how it's structured and the kind of support, you know, that it gets is what I hope that we can have here.
Yeah,
someday.
And I guess for the support, not just to come because you're doing well in a tournament, but to know that it actually starts from the bottom. You don't just wake up one day and you're on the top of the mountain.
Exactly.
You have to walk up there.
So
how does somebody support women rugby? Like if I hear this story and I'm like, that's a good thing to be a part of.
Mm.
How would you say in different ways different people can support Kenyan rugby? Mm. Kenyan women's rugby.
So number one, show up for the games.
Mm.
Right. We do have more people showing up now, but when I started with the women's team, we literally would be playing to empty seats.
Mm.
Or if there was people there, they were there to watch the game. And when the women came on, that was your time to go get a beer. That was your time to go to the loo. You know, but at least now the women have proven that they are worth watching. And so you find that there's actually people that come in to watch them, but definitely still not pulling as big a crowd as their male counterparts pull. So one quick way to support them is buy a ticket and come watch a game, you know, when the women are playing. And then understand again that we're dealing with diverse backgrounds. At Kenya Harlequins, we partner with an organization that's actually helping school-going girls to get their fees, to get the different commodities that they need to go into school. So their stationery, their uniforms, and so on. And so consider that some of the people that you watch, some of the women that you watch playing, sometimes even at a national school, I mean, at national team level, need that kind of support. They're still trying to go to school. So can we get scholarships? You know, they're still trying to pay their rent. Can they get jobs? You know, so I mean, basically, these are human beings, is what I'm trying to say, with the same challenges that you're facing, but every weekend putting their bodies on the line to represent your country. You know, and so any way that you can think to give back is definitely a way that would be appreciated. Or just advocate for better playing conditions, you know, advocate for corporates to begin to see value in investing in the women's game, same way that they invest in the men's game. You know, so advocacy is also great.
Okay, I like that. So I think one of the questions I've been debating whether or not to ask, but maybe I should just throw it in there, is in terms of structure, would you say it's advisable for us to, apart from the grassroots, which I think is starting to come up, the structure of getting the different teams or different clubs to focus now on making sure that they have a women's rugby team. Would that be the ideal way to go about this whole thing?
That's a good question. So thanks for asking it. Because it gives me the opportunity to talk a little bit about community clubs, which is what majority of us are. Does that make sense? Majority of the clubs are community clubs, is what
the
I'm trying to say.
Community clubs.
Yeah.
But what other clubs are there?
So you also have clubs that are backed by corporates. So KCB Rugby, for example, might not be a community club. It's affiliated to KCB Bank, you know. And so, for example, the players are on more than a stipend. It's a generous kind of regular payment.
They eat different.
Right? And they are... their structures, their performance, you know, they're held to account by the club, by the bank, you know. Whereas Kenya Harlequins that I belong to is a community club, which means it's people like me who have presented themselves for consideration to join the executive committee and support the club. It means there's alumni who give of themselves, give their time, give money to support the club. There isn't real corporate backing. Yes, we have some corporate partners, but we're really not talking at the level of being backed by a corporate entity, you know. And so the success of the club, the finances of the club are primarily pegged on the generosity of its members and whether or not they feel that they want to give back, you know, in time and so on. Do they want to give a player an internship? Do they want to contribute towards the team going to Mombasa to honor a fixture? You know, and so if the membership is not engaged, then the club doesn't thrive. And that's, you know, that really is the key difference. So if you have majority of the clubs as community clubs that really are struggling to make ends meet, that it might be unfair to insist that they then have to have another team, whether it's a women's team or, you know, whether it would be unfair to insist that they have to participate in a specific league because they probably don't have the funding to do it, you know?
Yeah, it's like forcing somebody to carry a cross. Like,
yes, you know, when they're not Jesus.
Yeah, and they have their own. They're probably carrying five other crosses from life generally. Yeah.
Exactly. So it really is a preference, you know, or a decision that they make on their own. You know, if you have the calling to develop the sport in that regard, then you do that. And for Kenya Harlequins and for clubs like Mwamba and Impala, they felt the need to promote the women's game by having, you know, women's teams as well.
You know why I thought of it, actually? Because I feel like it would be so important to it. For me, it looked like a way to grow a family. Because from what you're saying, it seems to be a very important component of the game. And I think now I understand why, as a football lover, why rugby people can be a bit irritating, because they just like all love each other. They're like, oh, we're so special. And oh, you don't have a knee injury. You don't, I know that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But I was looking at it from that point of view.
Yes.
Would it be easier to have a women's rugby team thrive because they're part of this bigger family. Mm. And even in terms of the fans, would they be able to appreciate them better? Or, you know, just make sure that these are our sisters. These are our people. So you have to treat them right when they come onto the pitch. That's how I was thinking about it.
And you know, you're exactly right. So for the clubs that have women's teams, that is a relationship, you know, and that is how it works. Mm. You know, whether it's our men playing, whether it's our women playing, there's going to be that level of support. And we're going to put in an equal amount of energy to make things work for them. You know, the difference only comes in, and actually there was a point where the Kenya Rugby Union tried to create a system in which if you had a Kenya Cup side, then you had to have a women's side as well. But it's impossible to just do that and expect for it to happen when community clubs are struggling with a million other things. Mm. So on paper, I would say definitely a great plan. But then is it something implementable is then what was questionable. And in the end, it turned out that, you know, that it wasn't. But where you have women's teams, they do integrate completely into the clubs, into the club system.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that. So let me, okay, we can wind up the conversation a little bit. And I'd like you to tell me a bit about the structure of the conversations you're going to have. Mm. So who are some of the people that we expect to see on your podcast? Mm.
So obviously players, current players,
nice.
But then also some former players, you know, that impacted my life, or just watching them was a huge influence on where I am now. So I look forward to the audience meeting those women. But like I said, I didn't play rugby. And so a lot of people always ask, okay, so what are you doing here? Can't you just be a fan, sit in the stands like the rest of us?
You don't know what we're going through. You
know? Yeah. And actually sometimes when you're having a conversation with someone and you're talking about rugby, they're like, ah, so you played, and you say no. They're like, you know. But there's so much to do outside of the pitch. You know, there's lots of stuff that needs to get done to make sure that what happens on the pitch works well. And so I also want to highlight those women that have been part of those journeys of rugby clubs, of rugby administration, who perhaps never passed a ball, you know, never took the pitch, but whose contribution to the sport continues to be incredible. I really want to highlight those stories.
I think because in like when you're saying it in my head, I'm like, there's a lot of sacrifice involved.
There is a lot of sacrifice. You give, and you definitely now have to begin to balance things, because it takes time away from your family. It takes time away from your job, you know. And so sometimes you need to really want to be there. Is what I'm trying to say. It doesn't work any other way. And so the kinds of people that I want to bring to this podcast are people that are so passionate about the sport, that would do anything for the sport, that gave a lot of time and effort, gave a lot of their life to the sport. And so I would really want for people to meet them and honor them the way that I have honored them and hope to honor them through this podcast. But I also want to acknowledge men or other people who've contributed to the growth of the women's game. I like to call them the allies of the women's game, whether coaching them.
You can't do it alone.
Yeah. Or mentoring them, you know, people who, if you were to Google women's rugby, you probably don't see their names, because again, no one has been telling the story of women's rugby across the continent, but women's rugby wouldn't be there without them, you know? And so that's who this space is for. Mm. Yeah.
You know, as you're talking, I just remembered that, yeah, she doesn't play rugby. Mm. Yeah, she's never played rugby. So what exactly do you do when you're not, you know, part of the rugby club or part of the rugby community? What do you do?
When I'm not part of the rugby community?
Yes. What are you paid to do? Since I don't know what you're paid to have this conversation.
That's true. I'm paid to build a community of practice around community health. Mm-hmm. So I work for an organization called Medic. And Medic is a steward of the community health toolkit community, which is basically a community of people that build digital health tools for community health workers. And so my job is to make sure that all our different pieces, all our different community members know each other, understand each other, and can work collaboratively for the good of the digital health space.
I think because I know Nekesa, I think you should Google her, because she's given you a small bit of who she actually is, and she's a lot more. So just please watch out for that. So if I want to be part of this conversation, where will I find these conversations? Because I think there's a big community you've unlocked here that would love to hear their stories. So where would somebody interact with your podcast?
So definitely on Spotify or anywhere else that you get your podcasts, it will be there. We'll be on YouTube. Can catch some snippets on Instagram. African Women's Rugby Stories across all platforms.
There we go. So Africa Women's Rugby Stories. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called.
That's what it's called.
Okay.
Yeah.
Welcome. Welcome to the set. Yeah. I wish you the very best with your podcast, because even I didn't know, I mean, I know we talked about having this conversation, but there are a lot of aspects, I think, about women's rugby that I don't know, starting from a Kenya level before you get to the Africa level. And I'm really looking forward to these conversations.
Thank you.
All the best, Nekesa.
Thank you.
Next time when you sit on the red seat, you'll be the one asking the questions.
Yeah.
But I know that you're very inquisitive, and also you...
Do I bother you with my questions, Laura? Is that what you're trying to say?
Because I ask so many questions and you have to think before you answer them. But that's a good thing, because I think that's always the best way to interact with people. That's always the best way to get to know what somebody's about. So thank you. I'm looking forward to watching this podcast. I'm looking forward to be a part of this podcast in whatever way possible. So I would just say, as Nekesa said, all the places where you listen to your podcast, all the different social media platforms that you enjoy visiting, look for African Women Rugby Stories.
I'm really honored, Laura, that you would take time to give me my soft landing into the podcasting space. I'm obviously taking myself out of my comfort zone, but I feel so passionate about telling these women's rugby stories that I'm happy to be uncomfortable for as long as I have the space to do it. And so honored to have you, who's been seasoned interviewer, seasoned podcaster, to teach me and kind of set me off on this journey. So thank you.